Good afternoon. It is 1:31 p.m., March 26, 2025. This is a North Dakota Public Service Commission, an MDU informal hearing on case number PU-24-388. And all the commissioners are here. We have staff here. We have MDU here. We'll go around and identify everybody at the table. I don't have any opening comments, Commissioner Kringstad, do you? Commissioner Haugenhoffert, I'll just turn it over to you for opening comments and to lead the case and have everybody introduce themselves, please.
Okay. Well, good afternoon. This was good.
I want to emphasize this is an informal hearing, so we can deal in only undisputed facts. If there are any disputed issues that come up, we would have to recess this and reconvene in a formal hearing process. No.
Good afternoon. Thank you guys for your flexibility. I know this got scheduled very quickly, so we appreciate that. Before we get started in the presentation, I'll just have everyone go around who's at the table so they know who's here in your title.
Darcy Nigam with Montana Dakota Utilities, Vice President, Energy Supply.
Allison Walden with MDU Resources Group, representing Montana Dakota Utilities Senior Counsel.
Travis Jacobson with Montana Dakota, and I'm in the Regulatory Group.
Victor Shook with PSC Staff.
Chris Hansen, PSC Staff.
Okay. Well, thank you. I know you guys have, we have a PowerPoint in front of us, and I think what's worked very well is to have you guys go through the PowerPoint. And just for clarification, if we have any questions, do you want us to ask at the end or as you go through, as we go through? Okay. Okay, so I'll turn it over to MDU.
Yeah. Good afternoon, commissioners, and thank you for the invitation today for this discussion. We've already done introductions, so I won't go through that again. But just to start as a quick introduction to the matter, we are here to discuss Montana Dakota's application requesting to defer external legal expenses related to congestion litigation and to record those deferred expenses into our regulatory asset. The company has prepared a presentation, so I will turn it over to Mr. Jacobson for that.
Okay, and before we go any further in the slide deck, I wanted to give some background on the filing itself and the matters around that. The congestion costs underlying our request originated really from the Northwest North Dakota load pocket. And this is a load pocket that's seen significant growth in the pocket in general. However, Montana Dakota's growth has been pretty constant over the last several years. The load pocket is located within SPP or the Southwest Power Pool area. And
just one second. Is that next slide? Is that what it is?
No.
Okay, sorry. I was looking at load pocket on here.
Oh, we'll get there.
Okay. Patience,
huh? Okay. And then just a reminder that we take transmission service from both SPP and MISO. So in 2023, a number of events happened. There was additional load that was added in that pocket, including a large data center. There was reduced gas turbine availability, and then there was also reduced wind farm output. And all of that resulted in a pre-contingent overload of the Charlie Creek to Watford City line in anticipation of the loss of the Charlie Creek to Patton Gate. And when we get to the map, Darcy will explain that more eloquently than I can. And then just because of that potential overload, SPP initiated congestion management on a market-to-market basis. In August of 23, we started to notice a spike in market congestion charges at both MISO and SPP. We had conversations with the commission at that time individually on October 18th and on the 20th, just to talk about the situation and update the commissioners that we were communicating with MISO, SPP, Basin, and the affected RECs to better understand what was going on, what was driving those higher charges. From August of 23 through the end of February 2024, Montana-Dakota incurred approximately $21 million of unjustified duplicative market congestion costs through MISO and SPP. And then just for reference, Montana-Dakota is about 73% of that, or $15 million. So on March 1, 2024, a remedial action scheme was implemented in that area, which was very effective in mitigating the congestion. And then that was immediately noticed in our congestion charges, where we saw a significant reduction from that point going forward. Mid-year last year, Basin placed another transmission service line in, and that created an additional transmission path. You know, I mentioned earlier growth. You know, the conditions are still in a way that is promoting growth in that area. And what we see then is, even though there are some mitigating circumstances, the risk of a similar situation still exists. The complaints and ultimately the court filing that we made were to ensure that we do everything that we can to mitigate the possibility of future cost increases. And then lastly, as you're aware, the congestion costs are a pass-through to our customers, and they've been included within our fuel and purchase power adjustment, rate 58, monthly and then annually as well. Last week, we filed our annual filing. We've had a significant amount of recovery from customers, and the balance has been reduced pretty significantly. So we're making progress on that, and we're seeing you know, that those are getting to be taken care of. So with that, we'll move to the map.
Can I ask you a couple questions?
Yes.
When you talked about, you went through the growth in 2023 out there, did MDU have any growth out there?
So we have not seen much for growth in that area, so I think our load's been pretty flat, I think, about the last 3-4 years out there without really experiencing anything. Since the Bakken growth started, I think we've added about 50 megawatts total. That would go back to, like, 2012. The majority of that was up through, like, 2018, 2019 is probably when the most of that was, about 50 megawatts. You know, in contrast to that, the total load growth in the pocket is over 1,000 megawatts, so at least on a prospective basis.
Okay. Then somebody else?
Go ahead.
Oh, my other question, you talked, Travis, about what you guys did for mitigation. Can you explain that a little bit more, what you did during that time period, or Darcy?
So the piece that Travis talked about, mitigation, was the remedial action scheme, and that's what Basin applied to at least the large customer load up in the Williston area. That would be in February of 2024 that went in service. So basically the remedial action scheme is a protective scheme out of the relays. So what happens is, and we get to the map, maybe I'll go to the map and then I'll give you the answer to that.
Thank you.
So when we talk about, you know, the load pocket up in the Bakken, you know, the gray area outlines the area that's defined by that, and the lines that contribute where the flow comes in and out are really the ones that have, you know, the green arrows that it reflects. This is the path we talk about. There's the blue line and the parallel red line. So the 230 kV line is the blue line, and the red line is the 345 kV line. And so the contingency that the RTOs were worrying about is if the red line would trip, the 345 kV line would trip, all that flow then would want to go across the blue line, or the 230 kV line. So the blue line is to Charlie Creek to Watford City. And that's the line that was concerned about overloads. And so in doing that, when they put the congestion management in place, they're trying to reduce flow on that line by basically trying to get more generation in the Bakken, so they're flowing less flow up that line. And that's really what it's trying to do. You know, the place that it got in place is there was no more generation to call online because everything was either being called upon or was in maintenance, or at least in the case of the wind projects, the wind wasn't blowing that's up there. So the remedial action scheme looked at the status of the red line, the 345 kV line, And if that line would trip at the same time, it would trip the large load, the data center load in Williston. So that way it wouldn't contribute to the overload of the parallel 230 kV line. And so it put the transmission system back to the way it was before that load was added, of which there was not this congestion issue.
So was the data center the first thing that was interrupted, their service, when?
So again, this is all on a pre-contingent basis. Mm-hmm. They would see that if the red line, the 345 kV line, would trip, that what it would cause would be an overload of the 230 kV right. line. In the actual real time when this was occurring, there was no overload in place. So the overload happens after you have an outage. It causes an overload. So they try to pre-position the transmission system, so at least if that line would trip, there isn't an overload. Mm-hmm. And that's the place they were using congestion management for. So the large load, the data center, was never tripped because that line never tripped out of service that would have caused it to trip with the remedial action scheme. It was all just a pre-positioning, at least of loads in the area, so there wasn't an overload if that 345 kV line would trip.
Okay. Thanks.
Darcy, did the remedial action scheme just require that the data center go offline if that tripped? That also became vulnerable to that.
So there are two pieces
of that scheme.
Yep, there's two pieces in that, Commissioner. One, so the remedial action scheme only impacted the data center load. It was the only thing that was tied to it. The other thing is McKenzie Electric had some loads that were basically at risk as well because they were opening the ring bus up around the Watford City area. So that way, if the 345 kV line would trip as well, not through the remedial action scheme, but the way the substation breakers were positioned, potentially there would have been a loss of some of McKenzie's load at the same time.
So this whole thing has threatened customers in the McKenzie County Electric area.
They would have been at greater risk for an outage as well.
Okay.
Yep.
Follow-up question on that, and maybe an observation. It's my understanding that the RAS was taken off when the Roundup to Coomer Ridge line was built, correct?
It was removed, and I believe that's because SPP was requesting it to be taken out of service because it wasn't the limiting contingency anymore.
Right.
Yep.
So when that new line got built, they didn't need the RAS anymore, presumably.
It wasn't the limiting contingency.
Yep.
I'm not sure if this is a question for Travis or Darcy, but in your initial memo, it talks about in the absence of permanent corrective action, how you guys believe it's possible that this could happen again. Have you seen any permanent corrective action from either like the RTO or other utilities in the area?
So there is no change in status as far as how the RTOs are interpreting that congestion management. That's one of the things as we continue to pursue legal action is to try to ensure that at least that duplicative congestion and the coordination that we saw doesn't occur. And that's kind of the underlying piece, the mechanics that's out there, is that if we would get into some other prior outages or something that would put us back into the situation where they're trying to do this coordination of congestion, we end up seeing we'd be subjected to the duplicative costs again. Mm-hmm. Because nothing's changed at the way the RTOs are interpreting this or managing.
I can quickly explain the duplicative costs.
So the duplicative costs result from the fact that, you know, MDU's, all of MDU's load takes transmission service from Southwest Power Pool in the area. So this will date back to when Wappan Basin joined Southwest Power Pool in 2015, that in that case, the transmission agreements that we had with Basin and Wappa went away. And so what we were left to do was to take tariff service from SPP as the regional transmission organization. And so historically, we had used each other's facilities, had jointly developed transmission. And one of the ways, at least in Northwest North Dakota, we had invested in other places. And they ended up having all the transmission, really, that delivered energy into the pocket itself. So we had to take 100% transmission service in that area from Southwest Power Pool, in addition to the service we were taking from MISO. So from the standpoint how SPP looked at our load is that they were providing transmission service. And so when it got to congestion management, in the settlement agreement they had, they required us to pay the market congestion in that area if something would happen in a redispatch. So in the case of this congestion in northwest North Dakota, we were getting billed under our transmission service, not for energy in SPP's market, but for the congestion portion that they would have in the LNPs. And so that's one way we paid for congestion, the redispatch that SPP had on their system. And separately, because SPP asked MISO to do the market-to-market coordination, they were then trying to move LNPs up in the MISO pricing nodes in that area as well. So we incurred that same level of congestion on the MISO side. So we paid the SPP market congestion and the MISO market congestion in the same area for the same constraint. And that ends up being a duplicative charge. And so we're not contesting we shouldn't have to pay for congestion. It's just we ended up paying for it twice, where other loads up in that area only paid it once.
One other thing maybe would be helpful to speak to, Darcy, is what facilities MDU has running up to that area.
So MDU, and this would be part of the joint development of transmission that we had, we do own, let's see if it works this way.
It does.
Okay. From the Williston area, we do have a 115 kV line. This is Williston here, if I got my eyes right, that runs all the way over to Kenmare and then up to Lignite. That's the 115 kV path that we own, and it's all inside of the Williston load, or inside of this northwest North Dakota load pocket itself. And then there's a little bit of the 115 kV line we own from Granor over to Plentywood as well.
And that 115 is more than sufficient to serve the, I forget how many megawatts you said you have up there, 150
Correct.
Megawatts. That is more than adequately sized to serve Correct. That. But because of energy flowing on the path of least resistance, you have to pay SPP for that service because it's assumed that your electrons will flow on the 345 and the 230 before they would flow upon your 115.
And if you take a look at all of the green lines that basically have the energy that flows into the pocket, we don't own any of these.
Okay.
So we have to flow across these lines to get service up into the area. And that's how I say we take 100% network transmission service for all of our load up in that area from Southwest Power Pool. So the load is considered an SPP load customer
sure.
from a transmission standpoint. And so we pay the full tariff.
Sure. But and maybe this was just my understanding, not being correct, but I was under the impression that you did have at least 115 lines that ran all the way up into that area.
We don't have the 115 kV lines that run into the area.
Just within
the area itself. Right. We have no lines that will cross that boundary and connect to our other facilities.
Okay.
Just of the way we've jointly developed transmission.
Right. Okay.
But, and so how much does closing the Sydney plant impact this, though? Like, you didn't need to cross those lines if you had your own generation up there.
So the Sydney plant, one for which sit just outside of the load pocket itself. So it sits right down here in this area. And the Sydney plant was 40 megawatts in size that it was. So 40 megawatts inside of a load pocket that was over 1,500 megawatts is a very small resource. And it would not have changed, you know, the situation of if this congestion management would have happened or not. It was too small of a resource.
Just to expand upon that, so what you're saying is you would have still had, even though you would have had enough generation for your load probably or whatever your load would have been, it still wouldn't have alleviated the overall congestion into the area that you weren't causing mostly. And so it still would have, you still would have incurred these costs.
Correct.
That way. Okay.
Yep.
Darcy, just to clarify, when you were talking about like the blue Charlie Creek to Watford line and then the red Charlie Creek to Pattengate line, both of those transmission lines are in SPP, or is one in MISO and one's in SPP? Nope. They're both SPP.
They're both SPP okay. lines.
Is there something that's is it unique to this particular area because of the growth and such? Because it seems like this could happen at any point in time where you have a seam between two RTOs, theoretically. But obviously this was a pretty big deal. We heard this on the SPP side and you guys and on the MISO side. So is this a defect with the tariffs, the way they work between RTOs, or is there anything other than the low growth that's particular to this area geographically that caused this?
So it is a seams issue, and this can happen in similar manners along the seam itself. You know, the one thing that I think enhances this is just because of the growth in the area and the heavy dependence on transmission that we have to be able to serve the load in the area.
Gotcha.
And so it's one of those pockets that it's transmission deficient for a lot of the times, which is why you have to run local generation within the pocket to meet the needs that are there. The other one that makes it a little bit unique in our situation is we're taking 100% service from both RTOs. Where a lot of times when you see these seams issues, others have rights or they have some other way that energy can kind of flow into an area. Where this way it's kind of a pocket that's right at the end of the Eastern Interconnect. And so there really is, it's kind of almost like an island by itself on the end of the system.
And when you say in the area, are you talking about the gray shaded area?
Yes.
When you say the load pocket
yep.
in the area. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, the large communities would be Watford City and Williston. But do you have an estimate about how many communities are in there that MDU serves?
Maybe it's 25, somewhere in that 25.
And can you provide me with your load or your load growth, say, from 2020 to now?
We could.
In that area.
Yeah, we could.
So you said 2020?
Correct. Because that gives us a few years before this situation developed.
Not to jump ahead on some of the FERC complaint, but did they modify the agreements at all? I know that they declined the legal case, or it's under review now, or FERC declined it, but it's under review with a court of appeals. But did they modify the way that this process worked at all between the past and now, or not?
No, there has not been any change.
Okay.
And their interpretation of how the tariff works with the joint operating agreement.
Okay, I have a question. You've indicated that you had agreements in SPP and MISO. You know, so when you, because you're in both RTOs, what agreements were there that you understood regarding congestion and rates that you had in place, and then the congestion happened and those costs. I mean, did you know that you were subject to potential those costs, or because there had to be an understanding? I'm wondering, I guess what I'm trying to say is, were you surprised or not surprised based on, because I would assume that agreements were signed or have an understanding.
Yeah, in 2015, when Wappan Basin would have joined Southwest Power Pool,
mm-hmm.
we did intervene in their filing to join SPP,
mm-hmm.
largely over the seams issue and concerns as far as how it was going to work for service our customers would take and what we would pay for. So as part of that, there was a settlement agreement that we had through that FERC intervention that talked about how MDU takes transmission service from Southwest Power Pool,
okay.
what we pay for, and then in the case of congestion, it specifically says in there that congestion would be per the SPP tariff, and we would pay that for the redispatches that happen on SPP system. And so in that was the basis for our complaint, is if we're being asked, and it's in the joint operating agreement, to pay the SPP market congestion, so that way it makes sure that if they're moving generation around because of our load as well they're giving service for, they shouldn't then also go and ask MISO to coordinate congestion management under the joint operating agreement, because that isn't what they agreed to in the settlement agreement that said it would be per the SPP tariff.
And that was with FERC in 2015?
It was part of a FERC settlement. I think the docket was actually had a 2014 case number to it because that's when we filed the intervention. But that settlement agreement dictated that we were to pay SPP for market congestion specifically for issues like this that ended up happening.
And Darcy, I want to make sure that I understand, you know, terminology here. Mm-hmm. That here, when we have a settlement with somebody, usually that would suggest that all sides seem to agree to how it was going to work and signed off on it. So when you're saying this FERC settlement, is that what that was, that everyone agreed on, or is that just what FERC calls their orders?
Nope. So all the parties agreed to that and were signatories to it. So MDU signed that, Basin signed that, WAPA, Heartland, because they were all part of the IS system that WAPA had in place, and then also SPP signed that, and so did MISO. So there were six signatories to that.
FERC, SPP, MISO, yep. Basin, so MDU.
So FERC was not a signatory to that. The settlement was under a process that they would have had.
Okay.
So the parties are WAPA, Basin, Heartland, MDU, MISO, and SPP.
Got it.
So just for clarification, it wasn't the basis of that settlement that you got charged by SPP, was it? So if you hadn't had that settlement, would you've only been charged by MISO? Or was it the basis that that settlement caused SPP to be able to charge you directly, and yet they still did the cross charge? I guess was that part of the reason you had duplication of costs?
So the settlement agreement required us to specifically pay for the congestion to the SPP market.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As part of that, MISO or SPP also looked at how they manage, you know, congestion flow gates along the seam, and saw this was a flow gate that they could coordinate with MISO, so they asked for that reciprocal control. But in that case, the only load that's a part of that load that experienced that congestion management was MDUs. Mm. There's no one else's load that was impacted. And so we ended up saying this is a local issue with the other part of the FERC complaint, saying this is not a regional issue with regional flows. It deals only with a local issue. Mm-hmm. And so there shouldn't have been this cross coordination because we're already paying for the congestion management in the area.
Mm-hmm.
But when they required MISO to also have the reciprocal congestion management, we ended up with the duplicative charge.
And as I recall,
which is contrary to what's in the settlement agreement.
And correct me if what I recall you saying too is basically MISO was charging you for an action, but they really had no ability to correct the action either. So that was part of the, wasn't that part of the thing too, is that essentially you were paying for something where they didn't really have the ability to get any additional power into the area. So it was kind of
correct.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so is Basin arguing that that settlement agreement says differently than what you're saying, or were there subsequent actions taken by SPP and MISO that they would interpret as changing that settlement agreement?
So in the original complaint we had with FERC, the parties as far as SPP and Basin really focused on what's in the joint operating agreement and how congestion is managed between the two RTOs. You know, we ended up bringing up the specific language in the settlement agreement. The other parties focused just strictly upon how congestion is managed on the seam between the RTOs and as far as when it's appropriate to have this reciprocal congestion management between them. And they were silent on the language in the settlement agreement.
Okay.
And then the basis of the did FERC specifically address the settlement agreement, or what was the basis of them rejecting that? I mean, in summary.
So FERC in the settlement agreement, or not in the settlement agreement, sorry, as far as it dealt with the original complaint, they mainly focused on the conditions in the joint operating agreement as far as when, you know, a flow gate should be reciprocally coordinated between the two RTOs in our sense. And there really wasn't an answer or looking at the specific language that was a part of the settlement agreement.
So maybe I'll move to the next slide. just not to interrupt the flow, but, you know, just we've kind of talked about the complaint.
Interesting choice of words.
No pun intended on that one. Just to kind of lay out the dates, you know, the original complaint, and I think we've covered that a little bit already, was January of 24. And then, obviously, FERC rejected both complaints. And MISO filed a similar complaint against SPP, you know, at the same time we did. Then in October of 24 was when we requested a rehearing, and that rehearing was also denied. And then, so at that point, we had already incurred a little over $500,000 in legal costs, and then the next step would be to go to the district court. And we felt it was appropriate to do that. Again, these costs are ones that go through to our, pass through to our customers. And so then we went to the district court, and that was done in early January of 25. And then MISO filed a similar request at the same time. And at this point, there has been no action taken by the district court, so that's just still pending there in front of the circuit court. And so I don't know if there's more questions on the complaints, the filings, the legal process.
What would be the, is there any expectation as far as whether when they'll hear it or rule on it, or I mean, what's the turnaround time, or is it indefinite basically, or they could they stay silent potentially?
I think they're working on setting the procedural schedule. When we ended up filing with the Eighth Circuit Court, and the new administration came in, there was a request to hold the proceeding in abeyance, so at least FERC could look at what was in the complaint, and they ultimately did file an order at least to the rehearing request, and that came out last week. And so that would be the piece where now it could go over and the record could go to the district court, and they'd be able to pick it up and go through their process.
Okay.
Because your avenues at FERC are, like, exhausted, right? There's no other remedies potentially available through FERC.
So the remedy would be the rehearing request as far as the original order. And then so the remedy of that is then to go off to one of the district circuit courts.
Okay. So that's what you're trying to accomplish now at the district court level, is to get them to, say, have FERC rehear it.
That looking at the record and basically saying, does the district court agree with our interpretation and the arguments, which would basically be to remand it back to FERC. So we would hope for to basically say that they got the decision wrong.
And then would the process be, it would go back to FERC for rehearing, or does, like, the court, the district court saying FERC is wrong, is that then the final decision?
That should be the final piece, and as far as directing them to take some action, is the outcome that we would hope for.
Okay.
Does a remand say that they got the decision wrong, or say that they didn't appropriately explore something or something like that? I don't think it necessarily says they got the decision wrong.
It can. I think, or they could explore something else. Yeah. I think that was the avenue I think we would hope that it would happen, was when they would look at the entirety of the record, or at least the other points that we had made, they would send it back to them, at least on a remand.
Because the court could just overturn their decision, too. Correct. And if they just felt, well, no, you just got it wrong, then they would just overturn it.
Correct.
As opposed to sending it back for a new decision.
They could direct them as far as a change or a remand. They could send it back to them, maybe for more information, or I think they could actually change their decision for them and say this is what the court, by looking at the record, would have for their opinion of how it should have been handled by them.
Okay, and I know I don't understand the federal court system like I should, but you said district court a few times, and on here it says Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. So is the process here, like where you have appealed it to, is that a district court with a judge, and then presumably if whichever party's unsatisfied with that judge's decision, that the next step would be the Court of Appeals, or am I
wrong? So we're probably mixing, we're using two different terms for the same thing. We did file our petition with the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals.
So it would be a group of judges.
It'd be a group of judges.
Okay.
Yep.
And you can do that? You don't have to go to, like, we're hearing a lot about a certain case with flying some people somewhere and a judge deciding. Yeah. So you were able to skip that level, because that's in federal court.
Correct.
You were able to skip that and go right to the appeals.
That is the proper channel to go.
Okay.
If there's nothing more in regards to the appeal, I'll caveat. We can move on, and we can always come back if there's something that comes up. I had mentioned that we had spent, you know, a little bit over $500,000, and that was really related to our complaint with FERC and then the rehearing request. We are expecting that the appeal would potentially add an additional $500,000. Again, I mentioned earlier 73% is North Dakota's share. And, you know, essentially what we're asking in this docket is a request for deferred accounting to put those expenses in a regulatory asset rather than expense them in the current period. And then as that process plays through, we would then come back for additional direction and a plan for recovery of those costs. And in terms of recovery, I had mentioned that, you know, the $15 million of duplicative costs have been included in our fuel and purchase power adjustment, our rate 58. We do that monthly with an annual true-up. If we were successful in getting a reduction to the congestion charges, those charges would, by default, flow back through our rate 58. So the customers would receive the benefit of those proceeds through that. And then we would most likely request for the legal fees to be an offset within that mechanism. If we are unsuccessful, we would look to request in a separate filing or a general rate case for recovery of those dollars. Again, that's not really part of this deferred accounting request, but just kind of a foretelling of what we may look to do in the future. And with that, we would be open to other questions or if we've passed over anything.
So just to summarize that last, we're kind of in a hole, depends on what the decision is.
Yep. And, you know, I mentioned all of the congestion charges just by their nature flow through our fuel and purchase mm-hmm. power. You know, the benefit to Montana Dakota is we're going to be able to pass back, assuming successful, we would pass back these dollars to customers. There isn't a financial benefit for Montana Dakota in undertaking a legal challenge because any recovery would end up going right back to customers. You know, on a long term, we talked about it a little bit, and Darcy mentioned it, without a change in the tariff and the way things are working today, with continued growth, there is that risk that we'll end up with congestion at an elevated level again at some point in the future. I know there are some other more permanent activities that Basin is undertaking. There's an additional transmission line. I think there's some generation being sited up there. But again, based on the level of growth, that risk still remains. So somebody mentioned mitigation. You know, our goal would be to get the remove that duplicative charge in the event that congestion does happen again. And the way that we can do that would be through a legal challenge, and if we're successful in that. So I don't have anything else unless these
guys... I have another question. So if you're not successful, sorry, I'm not being a Debbie Downer, and the potential that you just addressed on more congestion charges, then what's your plan? This could keep going with load growth, and you guys are in that area. What's the plan then?
So one of the pieces we look at, and it goes through our integrated resource plan cycling, we do take a look at, you know, our SPP MISO membership. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the things that we would have to take a look at, and what are the options that we could take to basically continue to serve our load status quo as we are, or do we look to make some sort of change as to how we take service? Or the other alternative is we have to end up building generation, you know, that's greater than or equal to our load that we would have in that area, whether there would be a specific need for it or not, are the types of things we'd have to take a look at.
Do you guys see another way to, so like you said, part of this, it sounds like part of the legal challenge that you're doing is to correct the tariff so it doesn't happen again. If this legal challenge is unsuccessful, is there another avenue or another mechanism for that tariff to be corrected that could be explored?
So there is a process, at least, that the RTOs could agree amongst themselves, mm-hmm. you know, and basically amend the joint operating agreement. Okay. And so that would be holistically along the entire scene. And so they've had conversations about doing some of that in the past. I think any sort of changes they end up making, it's always the what are the pluses and minuses that mm-hmm. go along with that. And so they probably would not look as to how it's done just in that one area, but it would be how is it globally applied.
And can you just give me like a very high, because what you're saying, it sounds very simple, like, well, we'll just amend the joint operating agreement. I'm guessing it's not that simple. So like just really high level, what would that take? How would that look?
So both SPP and MISO would have to agree to that.
Okay.
And that's been the challenge, I think, to date when they've looked at this in certain situations. One party wants to change it, but the other one says, but I've got all these issues I'd like to talk about. And the other one says, well, I'd like to change this, but I've got all this other stuff I'd like to talk about. So nothing changes kind of in the status quo until there is something large mm-hmm. that makes a change, or maybe a legal challenge that makes them look at that. So,
One other question I had is, so admittedly, this is my first time going through like a deferred accounting case. So I know, Travis, you had said that, you know, instead of charging the expenses in the current period, the proposal is to put it into like a regulatory asset. So just kind of help me understand what you guys see as the benefits to having it get a deferred accounting treatment as a regulatory asset, as opposed to like it just being expenses period.
Yeah, and the real reason there is if we expense it, it becomes a income impact in a current period. And the benefit would come at a different time. So typically what you do is in a deferred situation is you try to associate the benefit and the recovery similarly.
Okay. Okay. That helps. Thanks.
So my understanding is, at this point, you're seeking the deferred accounting, but telling us that if unsuccessful, you would likely be coming back for recovery of our North Dakota's share of over $1 million of legal fees, right? So in that, when requesting it in this way, I don't feel like you're committing us to a answer on the second part, but I feel like our answer on the first part is kind of be viewed as a signal of what we would do going ahead. So I want to ask you this, because now I will be the Debbie Downer. How often do you see FERC being overturned by the federal court? I mean, is it frequent? Is it a rarity or what? So you can just answer more thoroughly. My whole thought is on this. At what point do you minimize your losses? You've lost $15 million because of the charges. It's already another $500,000 in legal fees. At what point do we quit spending money on this if it's not likely to be successful?
It's not uncommon for FERC decisions to be overturned by one of the district courts. I mean, it does happen. And I don't want to say it happens all the time, but it does happen. You know, there's a few cases I can think about. Some of those are the ongoing ones with the return on equity. The ROE remands have been back in front of FERC decisions. They go off to the courts. The courts send them back to do something else. One of the other ones that would be something that would have impacted us as part of Order 1000 dealt with the removal of the right of first offer, the ROFR language. And at least that was one of the places through that battle the ROFR language kind of got placed back into or was allowed to be a part of, in one way or another, the tariffs again. One of the other ways that it was brought back in are on the generator interconnection projects, you know, where we were no longer able to invest in those for upgrades that other were causing on our system. That would be the facility self-funded, the FSA agreements. That was another one of those that was through a remand sent back, or at least overturned what that FERC decision was. So they do happen. And those would be at least three cases, at least that I can think of, that had an impact to Montana Dakota Utilities.
And let's say it wasn't just a complete overturn, but the circuit court remanded it back to FERC. Can others involved with this appeal that somewhere else before FERC even ever revisits their decision? Or is that not how it works?
So I think it depends what the district court would come back with as far as what rights others have.
I have a couple of just clarifying questions on Lewis and Clark. So I'm trying to remember the time frame, which happened first, the chicken or the egg here, but did we agree to the early retirement of Lewis and Clark before the Rice units were added up there? I feel like the Rice units were added first.
The Rice units were added first before we had the retirement in analysis was part of the 2019 IRP.
Okay. And the Rice units total, I think it's 18?
18 megawatts.
Okay. And then the original Lewis and Clark coal unit was 40 megawatts.
It was 40 megawatts.
And I know in that proceeding where we had looked at all of that, the cost to operate that on a per megawatt hour basis was trade secret. I'm assuming since it no longer exists, maybe we don't need to worry about the trade secret nature of how much it costs to operate a plant that doesn't exist anymore. Do you recall the cost of energy for on just the coal and reagent basis for Lewis and Clark?
I think its operating cost was somewhere in that $35 to $40 a megawatt hour is where its dispatch cost was.
I was thinking it was higher than that, but I was confusing because it was we had Heskett 1 and 2.
Would have been higher, and they would have been, Heskett 1 would have been almost 50. What they were able operating costs were.
It's been a number of years. I was remembering them in my mind as much higher numbers. Like $75 a megawatt hour and $175 a megawatt hour stick in my mind. I just didn't remember where they plugged in.
And we did a revenue requirement analysis in that same IRP, which the delta on that was, closing versus maintaining those was in the neighborhood of $20 million a yep. year.
Per year.
Per year.
Yep. Yep. In savings to customers. Savings,
yeah. Yep. No, absolutely. I mean, we did all that analysis mm-hmm. at that time. I was just trying to recall the cost of energy from the Lewis and Clark unit specifically, because I'm sure if we dig back into the archives that we have it somewhere, but yeah. I just wasn't sure if anyone remembered it off the top of their head. So
it's in that $35 per megawatt range.
Okay. Thank you.
I do not.
Staff, any more questions? Do you guys have any Do you guys have any closing comments you want to make?
Just to thank you for your time today, commissioners, and then I do have noted the information that Commissioner Christman has requested, and we can file that as a supplement.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, so are there any objections to the evidence produced today becoming part of the record? And by the evidence, I'm referring to the slide presentation as well as the recording of our discussion.
No objection.
Okay, so then the evidence brought forward today in this informal hearing will become part of the record upon which a decision will be made. Is there anything else to add to this case?
Nothing from us.
Seeing none, this informal hearing is closed. Thank you.